Dave McGrath. It is now 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show will be spent analyzing a brand new book, which is an amazing, riveting account of how the Trump administration sought to respond to the threat of the corona COVID-19 pandemic. And it is a scenario that is chronicled in great detail by two reporters for The Washington Post, Yasmin Abutaleb and Damian Paletta. Damian is the economics editor at the Washington Post. Yasmin Abutaleb covers health policy for the Washington Post. And through these two different lenses, they view in great detail how the Trump administration struggled to respond to this unprecedented public health crisis. The book is titled Nightmare Scenario, Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. The book is published by HarperCollins. Yasmin Abutaleb, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Let's begin by having you briefly recount the difference you think it makes in terms of the focus of this book, the fact that you and your co-author, your fellow reporter at the Washington Post, Damian Paletta, come at this with, in a sense, different spheres of expertise and experience covering two very different beats. What difference does that make in terms of how you tell this complicated story?
I think Damian and I saw that as one of our biggest strengths as a team, that he knows the econ world so well, and he knew the economic advisors and the economic aides and the various agencies and in the White House so well, and that sort of power center. And I knew the health world very well, the Health and Human Services Agency, the CDC, the FDA, and then, of course, the health advisors in the White House. And I think this was a really good background for us to come at this from, because what ended up happening through the course of the Trump administration's response is that it was constantly the health advisors sort of pitted against the economic advisors, and those two things were rarely working together. It was always sort of viewed as, we'll either take the public health measures or we'll take the measures needed to shore up the economy. But for most of the response under the Trump administration, those two things weren't viewed as being able to work together. They were pitted against each other, and they sort of alternated as power centers throughout the response. So we hoped that between both of our backgrounds, we would be able to tell a really comprehensive and definitive account of how this response unfolded and what the major factors and things that were influencing the response were coming from.
You've already hinted at what may be your answer to this next question. I think one of the things that is really important to say at the outset is that because of the scope of this crisis, this threat, and the fact that so many things about it were unprecedented, it is the kind of challenge that would have been a ferocious challenge for any presidential administration. And it is a mistake to blithely assume that if this had occurred on President Obama's watch or under President Biden's watch, that it would have played out perfectly and smoothly. You do quote, however, an official at some place in the administration of Donald Trump saying this would have been hard regardless of whoever was president. With Donald Trump, it was impossible. In other words, there were things about the way the Trump administration functioned that made it an especially difficult scenario. Can you maybe outline one or two of the most significant things about the Trump administration and the way it operated that in a sense put them at what now looks like a serious disadvantage in terms of effectively contending with this threat?
That's such a great question, and I'm so glad you asked it, because I think this is really important to understand. I think, for starters, you're absolutely right. It would not have gone perfectly regardless of who was president. And I think you can see that now with President Biden in office. There was a good few months where vaccinations were ramping up and things seemed to be getting better. And, of course, now we've taken another sort of downward turn and things are getting worse again with the rise of the Delta variant, and you can see the administration struggling with that. So this virus is a formidable opponent and is able to outsmart even the most brilliant scientific minds. It's constantly ahead of us. So I think that's really important to understand. Having said that, because this is such a difficult virus to respond to, because it can spread asymptomatically, because it's a respiratory virus and is so contagious and keeps getting more contagious as time goes on, everyone has to be united in fighting the virus and not in fighting each other. And that, I think, was probably the biggest detriment of the Trump administration. A, you didn't have leadership coming from the top, and that stemmed throughout the response. The president didn't want there to be a clear person in charge with the authority and the autonomy to carry out what they saw fit. He wanted the ability to scare his advisors, to sort of rule through this environment of fear and intimidation, and he succeeded in that. And because of that, no one was really empowered to make the decisions that they felt were right, to rally people around a decision that they had made and sort of allocate resources appropriately. And so much time and energy was focused on people fighting their enemies and being pitted against each other and trying to come out on top, as opposed to thinking about what the country needed to be safe from the virus, what the country needed to for people to be able to protect themselves as best as possible, what they needed to do on supplies, on protective equipment, on testing. And that was such a detriment because so much time and energy was wasted on these fiefdoms and who was up and who was down and people trying to knock down their enemies, as opposed to everyone just coming together. Obviously, there are going to be disagreements. This is a tense situation. It's an enormous challenge. Of course, people are going to fight and disagree with each other. But that's not what we're talking about when we talk about the Trump administration response and the White House task force. This is knifing and backbiting and undermining each other. And that was hugely detrimental to the response. And then, of course, the leadership element. No one was in charge. And therefore, it meant no initiative lasted. You didn't bring the focus you needed to really complicated problems except the vaccine. And, of course, that was successful. So that was an example of what could happen if you were focused and you did bring appropriate leadership and resources to a problem. But they didn't do that for the rest of the response. And I think you saw that play out in a really devastating way.
You also mentioned that this crisis came at the beginning of year four of President Trump's administration. And by this point in time, of course, many of the people that he had taken on at the outset were long gone. And you and your co-author posed the question, who was left? A mix of family members, 20-somethings, hangers-on, fourth-stringers, former lobbyists, sycophants, and a scattering of competent, well-meaning aides who mostly kept their heads down. I mean, when you, to whatever extent that is an accurate description of who, in a sense, was populating the administration at this point in time, that does not bode well in terms of how this response to the crisis of COVID-19 would take shape.
No, it doesn't. And in year four, we very much knew who former President Trump was, right? He disdained sort of, there was a group of people who kind of saw themselves as the adults in the room at the beginning of his administration, people like Gary Cohn and Rex Tillerson and Jim Mattis, and all those people were gone. So the people who had tried to bring some semblance of order and, organization to the White House and to the administration more broadly had all been pushed out or fired or quit. And it was not a secret who the president was and how he governed his administration. It was chaotic. It was dysfunctional. He demanded unwavering loyalty, but of course didn't return it. And so the people who are there in year four know who he is. And you don't have people who normally would have been able to get a job in a different administration, Republican or Democrat. You just don't have the same caliber people in a lot of these jobs. You, of course, have very well-respected people throughout different positions in the government, but you also have a lot of people who are sycophants, who are not entirely qualified for their jobs, and who just frankly weren't up to the moment. There were people who were well-meaning, but were weak and were not up to the moment when probably what the country needed is people who were kind of unflinching in their ability to tell the president and his aides things that they didn't want to hear, to do what they thought was right, even if it meant risking their jobs. And you saw the consequences of that play out in a number of decisions. And I think one great example is when the president had that freewheeling press conference last April, where he recommended that people, maybe inject bleach to treat the virus. You saw a lot of his health officials struggling to simply say on TV that night and the next day, don't drink bleach. That is not safe. That is not a medical treatment. You saw them trying to tiptoe even around that. And I think that was so emblematic of the environment that they were operating in, the struggles that a lot of them were having, and what the consequences were. I mean, they were afraid to refute what was obviously bad and dangerous medical advice.
We're speaking with Yasmin Abdaleb, who covers health policy for The Washington Post, and she is one of the co-authors of a brand new book called Nightmare Scenario, Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. One of the things your book reminded me of was that President Trump found himself, in a sense, in a very awkward position at the outset of this crisis because of some of the policies he had put in place with the nation of China. And in a sense, he was proceeding on eggshells, although at some point that really changed. But explain why the fact that this virus apparently originated in China made this a situation that President Trump felt he had to approach very gingerly.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because this was really important to how the beginning of the response went. And the beginning, of course, is when you have the best opportunity to put in place the measures you need before cases explode. And they were obviously hampered in their ability to do that. Of course, it doesn't all rest with the president. There were some miscalculations on the part of the health and scientific advisors. But to your question about the president's relationship with China at this point, right when officials were beginning to learn about the virus and getting the first reports out of China, the president had just signed a trade deal with China that he thought was going to be central to his reelection. He had, of course, spent, a couple of years battling with China over tariffs and over trade. They'd gone back and forth. You had seen the market kind of seesaw over this ongoing fight. And then on January 15th, they signed a trade deal with a lot of fanfare in the East Room of the White House. And you see the president through January and February very afraid, not afraid, but very reluctant to criticize the Chinese president for how he was handling COVID, even though there were complaints from his advisors and from international health experts as well that China was not being transparent, that it was not letting international experts into the country to investigate the crisis and better understand the virus. China was not sharing samples of the virus to help U.S. officials better understand what they were dealing with and start developing tests and vaccines and treatments. But you saw the president anyway in late January and into February praising the Chinese president, saying he's doing such a great job, it's going to be handled quickly. And that, of course, was not the reality. And it's not what his advisors were telling him. They were telling him, China's doing a little bit better than they were doing with SARS back in 2002, 2003, but that's a low bar because they weren't sharing anything then, and they're still not sharing a lot now, but it's a little bit more than it was then. And you saw him just so afraid of rattling the market, of upending this trade deal, that he made a terrible political decision to keep praising the Chinese president, giving him praise that he didn't necessarily deserve at the time, because he wanted to maintain that deal and not see the market go down. And you saw this play out throughout the response. You, of course, saw the president take a dramatically different tack with China as the year wore on and turned to a strategy of blaming them entirely. But you did see this insistence and this obsession with not upsetting the market, with not seeing the market go down, dictate a lot of how he viewed the crisis.
I like the way you characterized at one point the information that we were getting from China at the outset of all of this. You called it, the information we were being given from China was spotty and selective. and when those two factors are controlling the kind of information emerging from China, that's obviously not a situation that is going to benefit anybody else. I so appreciated the dramatic way in which your book recounts what occurred with the Diamond Princess, which of course was this cruise ship in which this COVID crisis took a terrifying turn. You talk about this in the third chapter, which is called Trapped at Sea. At this point in time, of course, I think there's a grand total of maybe five COVID cases involving Americans, at least cases that we knew about. And then suddenly we have this situation with the Diamond Princess. Explain why this was, in a sense, such a horrifying turn in the crisis, and how the Trump administration sought to respond to it.
Yeah, that chapter was a really interesting one to write, because we learned so much more about that whole incident in reporting the book than when we were covering it in real time, and found that it was much more dramatic than we had known at the time. So the Diamond Princess was an important turning point in the response, because until then, like you had mentioned earlier, the information coming from China was spotty and selective. So U.S. officials did not have a great grasp of how this virus was spreading, how transmissible it was. For a long time, China was insisting that person-to-person spread wasn't happening all the way through mid-January, and the World Health Organization repeated that, and that, of course, turned out to not be true at all. So with the Diamond Princess, what that gave officials was their first kind of raw data set and their first look at how the virus behaved in real time and in real life. So you had hundreds of people trapped on this cruise ship. A man had tested positive and gotten off the ship, and officials then decide to quarantine the ship on the coast of Japan and have people do their quarantines on the ship. But what ends up happening is the ship effectively becomes a petri dish. It is the perfect environment for this virus to just ravage and spread out of control, because there's poor ventilation, people are packed closely together. So you start seeing people get infected at an alarming rate. You see the cases climb from 10 or 12 one day to 60 the next day to 140 the next day, and you just watch it progress that quickly. And there's this series of emails that a number of officials and former Bush administration officials are exchanging, saying, oh my God, this is so much worse than SARS. Look at how quickly it's spreading. They're kind of doing these calculations in real time based on what they're seeing play out on the Diamond Princess. And what happens is the U.S. officials are engaged in this big debate over whether they bring back the Americans from the Diamond Princess, and at what point they bring them back. The CDC has said they should do their quarantines on the ship and then be brought back. But then the ship was becoming so dangerous because people were getting infected so quickly. So they do decide to repatriate as many Americans as they can. They say, we're not going to bring back anyone who's infected, so we don't put other people on the plane at risk. But we need to have a contingency plan for in case someone starts showing symptoms on the plane. And what happens is when they start repatriating a couple hundred Americans and they put them on a bus and take them all the way to Tokyo to get on the State Department plane that they had chartered, they find that as people are about to board the plane, that 14 of the Americans have tested positive for the virus before they had loaded them onto the bus. They got the test results back late. And there's this big fight about whether do you bring them back, do you not bring them back, do we put them on the plane and potentially put other people at risk. And they ultimately decide in this big fight and sort of showdown between the CDC and an HHS official and State Department officials that they are going to bring the infected Americans back. And it's a big fight, sort of fought late at night and into early the next morning. They bring the Americans back. And when the president finds out that they've brought back 14 infected Americans, which means that the U.S. case count at that point had doubled, so it went from 14 to 28, he is furious. He says he doesn't want these people back here. This doubles his numbers overnight, which just shows you how he was looking at the crisis at that point. The numbers were a direct reflection on him. And that, of course, is when he suggests that, you know, perhaps that they should have people do their quarantines in Guantanamo Bay so that they don't count towards the U.S. case count. And that idea was, of course, scuttled, but the president brought it up a couple of times. It was just such a chaotic series of events where they're learning so much in real time. They're fighting over what's safe and what's not, and do you leave Americans behind? Do you bring them back? And it just sort of foreshadowed how enormous this challenge was going to be.
Right. And in a more sort of concrete, tangible way, you suggest that what you call this fixation on cruise ships had serious repercussions. In other words, they were so taken up with this question about what to do with these folks who have contracted COVID and are aboard this cruise ship that they are neglecting the matter of all kinds of other people streaming into the country on a daily basis who are bringing COVID with them and getting Americans sick. And that could have happened during any administration, but perhaps in this administration where things were a bit chaotic and diffuse in terms of leadership right from the start, it's more understandable that that their attention was diverted in a way that was probably quite counterproductive.
That's absolutely right. They thought the cruise ships were going to be this big challenge. They needed to figure out what to do with hundreds and thousands of Americans sort of stranded in various places overseas. And what that meant was that they were not paying attention to what was happening in the U.S. What do they need to do to get the rest of the country ready for this virus? They missed that so many cases were being imported from Europe, not from China. And that's, of course, what seeded the outbreak in New York. They missed that the CDC tests were not detecting the cases that were coming up in the U.S. and that they actually had a false sense of security about how low the U.S. case count was. The virus is actually spreading silently throughout the country, even though they were detecting very few cases. So this just really was a distraction. And of course, it was important to figure out what to do with those Americans to get people home. But so much time and resources were consumed with the cruise ships and what to do about cruise ships that they were missing what was unfolding in the U.S. And that, of course, set the country behind when they finally realized the virus had already exploded in the U.S. in early March.
One of the points in your book that I think is very important to make is, let me read what you say, developing a test to detect a new virus is never a simple endeavor. And that process is especially complicated when labs don't have real-life samples of the virus to develop and confirm that their tests work. So in other words, because that sort of validation process was not possible in the early going, that's why we had these defective tests that were failing us at a point when we were, in a sense, blindly putting our trust in them. But I think in this day and age, we tend to make kind of blithe assumptions about what's hard and what's not hard to do. But the fact that it was so incredibly difficult to create a trustworthy test, that is important for us to understand.
It is. And the other thing that's important to understand is that it should not have been that difficult. I think one of the big lessons learned is that you need to engage the commercial manufacturers and the academic labs, the people who do this all the time, really early on. You shouldn't assume that everything is going to go according to plan with the CDC test just because it has in the past. And I think that's what happened here. There was some overconfidence on the part of the agency and a little bit of taking for granted that the CDC had always done this. So, of course, they were going to do it in this crisis and that would be enough. But like you in the passage that you read, there were other issues that made this more difficult. It took longer to get real life samples of the virus because China wouldn't share them. And so it took until there was the first U.S. case before the CDC had a real life sample to work with. The CDC, of course, bungled the development of the test, and that, meant for almost all of February, we didn't have a working test. And that was just catastrophic, because that's when the virus was sort of silently seeding itself all over the country, and we were completely blind to that. And they didn't engage other test manufacturers and the academic labs for several weeks, and that of course also put the U.S. behind. Those are other resources we could have used that would have helped even when the CDC test wasn't working. So it was just, there were a number of challenges and a sort of terrible series of events that meant we were flying blind so much of February. And I think that's a point of the crisis that's going to be studied for a long time, because you want to respond early. You want to take as many measures as you can to prevent things from getting as bad as they did here. And that's not to say that if we had had a working test, things wouldn't have been bad. Of course, we still would have faced enormous challenges like every other country did. But it didn't necessarily have to be as bad as it was, and we didn't have to be as far behind as we were.
And your book points out that because of that serious misstep or series of missteps early on, one of the consequences of that is that we missed out on what you describe as a critical window where it could have prevented a catastrophic outbreak of COVID-19. But that window of opportunity was lost. We're speaking today on The Morning Show with Yasmin Abutaleb, who is a reporter for The Washington Post, about the book she co-authored called Nightmare Scenario, Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. Well, of course, ultimately, President Trump begins to be one of the faces of the COVID crisis. That is, when we see those televised conferences, we see President Trump at every single one of them for quite a long time. Help us understand President Trump's understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic. I think sometimes he is roundly and kind of carelessly criticized for never taking it seriously. He, of course, at one point contracted COVID himself. Is that kind of a up and down scale in terms of President Trump understanding the seriousness of this and versus other points in time when he was seemingly dismissive of its significance? How would you chart that?
Yeah, I think you've hit on something important there, which is that it's not as simple as saying he never took it seriously, he never cared, because that's not quite true. There were, of course, in the beginning, we know now from Bob Woodward's book that published in 2020 that he did understand how serious the virus was, you know, fairly early on, that this was not the flu, even though in public he kept making those comparisons. And then the important thing to note, I think it's easy for us to forget now, is he did call for a national shutdown, which, of course, was very painful economically. And we actually report in the book that his advisors were kind of shocked at how quickly he went along with the first two-week shutdown. And then his medical advisors, Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci, prevail in convincing him to extend the shutdown for another 30 days at the end of March. So he does agree to shut down the country, essentially, for 45 days. And that's not an easy decision. And when they did make the case that he needed to shut it down for another 30 days, he was scared. His friend was in the hospital in a coma, and he eventually died. He saw these images of body bags piling up outside of Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, which was near where he grew up. I mean, it was hitting home, and he was scared at that point. And so he did, at some point, appreciate how serious the virus was and the devastation that was happening because of it. And then, of course, he gets impatient with that. He gets impatient with these painful economic measures and completely reverses course and starts trying to sort of message away that the virus is serious, thinking he can convince people of that. So it's sort of an up and down scale. And then even in that weekend where he gets sick, he, you know, emerges from that defiant and saying, don't let it dominate your life, don't let it scare you, which was absolutely the wrong message at the time. But what Damien and I report in the book before that is that at an event that happened a few days before he tested positive for the virus with some Gold Star families, he was really upset with his staff. And he said, you're letting people get too close to me. If any of these people were sick, I'm going to get sick. And of course, this was a product of his own approach to the virus, that the White House was so careless that people weren't wearing masks and packing close together indoors. He wanted that as well, and he disdained masks. So he's not, of course, free of blame here. It stems from him. But there are these moments where you see him worrying about the virus, worrying about his own vulnerability. And, of course, we report that weekend he got sick, that he at one point they thought he wasn't going to make it out of the hospital.
Ultimately, if there is an astonishing success story here, it is in the way that vaccines are developed, and far more quickly than some were predicting. I mean, it is astounding that we ended up with one and then two effective vaccines in a relatively short amount of time. To what do you attribute that success in contrast to so many other aspects of our response to this threat that did not go nearly so well?
I think there are a few things that are responsible for the vaccine success. One is that there were researchers and companies and scientists researching this technology for 15, 20 years before this coronavirus came and these vaccines were needed. So it was not sort of sprung up overnight. There was long, hard work done well before this. But I think from the government side of things, this was the only aspect of the response, and it was the hardest aspect of the response, where they brought in a leader. They brought in an outsider, someone named Mansab Slaoui, who was a noted vaccinologist. He had been integral in the development of more than a dozen vaccines over the course of his career. He was the clear leader of this initiative. It was clear what the chains of command were, unlike almost every other aspect of the response. There was a board for Operation Warp Speed. There were clear lines of communication and leadership in this whole initiative with the companies, with the various government agencies. And you saw the government come together in a way that it hadn't for other parts of the response. You had the Health and Human Services Department running a big part of this initiative. They were partnered with the Department of Defense, which had logistics expertise. You had the Food and Drug Administration providing every resource it had to streamline the clinical trials for these companies, to make clear exactly what they needed from them for them to be able to move on to the next phase and to eventually get authorization. And you saw the government, you know, of course, throw money at these companies to take up the financial risk, to make sure that they all had access to manufacturing facilities so that they could start manufacturing doses of vaccine before they even knew if they worked, just eliminate that roadblock and that financial risk, and to make sure that they took out any lag time that existed in the vaccine development process. This was a really organized, well-run effort. And of course, you saw the vaccines developed in record time. Before this, the fastest a vaccine had ever been developed was in 4 years. So for it to go to under a year, it's remarkable. I don't think anyone really thought that was possible at the outset of this. And it's kind of devastating in a way, because it makes you wonder if they had brought that element of focus and resources and leadership to other aspects of the response, how different would things have played out?
A last quick question. We have not yet mentioned the name of Dr. Anthony Fauci, and your book begins with a very intriguing scene in which he has opened a piece of correspondence. It is filled with mysterious powder, and there is fear that it might contain anthrax or worse. And you describe this scene in careful detail. But I'm curious why you chose to begin the book in this way. What does it say about this whole situation that Dr. Anthony Fauci was facing this in the midst of this crisis?
I think Damien and I thought that scene was a powerful way to open the book, because it really exemplified how divisive the response had come and how fractured the country had become at that point in the pandemic. That incident happened in August. And Anthony Fauci is a longtime career civil servant, a government scientist who talks about the way viruses and infections behave and what we're learning and, you know, what we can expect. He comes on TV in every sort of big health crisis in the U.S. he had never taken on the prominence he did during the coronavirus for a number of reasons, including that he ended up being sort of pitted against President Trump a lot of times or contradicting him. Other presidents had really worked hand in hand with him. That was not really the case with President Trump. And that's seen, I think, the fact that this government scientist is getting death threats, is getting a letter full of powder because people don't like the message he's sending on the virus, which, you know, he was not perfect. But for the last few months leading up to that incident, he was basically saying, no, this virus is really serious. It's not going away. We're really worried about the fall. Even as the president was trying to say, it's fine, it's going away, you don't need to worry about it. And it was just such a clear example of how fractured the country had become. You had half the country that loved Dr. Fauci, that, you know, had signs in their yard for him, that hung on his every word. And then you had half the country that despised him and saw him as getting in the president's way, as wanting to undercut him. These conspiracy theories were spreading about him, and him and his family were targeted. And we also detail in that scene that Dr. Birx was also receiving letters, you know, telling her to kill herself or to hang herself, and that Dr. Redfield, the CDC director, had also received a letter full of powder. So it just showed how the country had become pitted against each other. You were either with the scientists or you were with the president, and it seemed you had to pick a side and couldn't be with both. And things had gotten so acrimonious that people literally wanted these people dead.
And talk about a nightmare scenario, even beyond the central nightmare scenario of the virus itself. It's an amazing book, again, titled Nightmare Scenario, Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. The very good work of two reporters for The Washington Post, Damian Paletta and Yasmin Abutaleb. The book published by HarperCollins. Yasmin Abutaleb, thank you so much for your reporting, for your good work, and for this remarkable book. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive.
Well, if you want to be taken on a wild ride in several senses of the word, then you should be reading a book called Eyeing the Flash, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist, written by Peter Fenton. And this is a book which takes us back to the early 1960s, to rural Michigan, and to Peter Fenton, who seems like a relatively normal young man until he meets up with a fellow student named Jackie, who ushers him into an incredible world, which gets called at one point sort of the underworld of the carnival. And it is an incredible journey, and it changes him in all kinds of different ways. And the result is a truly entertaining and also pretty thought-provoking and poignant memoir, again called Eyeing the Flash, The Education of a Carnival Con Artist. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And we have Peter Fenton with us for a few minutes to talk about this remarkable story and book. Peter Fenton, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Greg, thanks for having me.
You know, it's interesting. You've actually written a couple of books before this.
Yes.
It kind of amazes me that one would live out as extraordinary a story as this and not be just chomping at the bit to write it before anything else. Did you wait to write this book for any particular reason?
Yes, I think I had to process the whole experience because it was quite different than I expected to live my life working on the carnival business. I was just a straight-ahead student and never expected to wind up running around on the carnival circuit, so it took me a long time to kind of figure out what attitude I had about it.
So you've been kind of coming to terms with this over the years.
Right. I mean, I did things that I guess I could say I feel guilty about now, although I didn't think about them think about them in that way at all when I was actually doing them as a teenager, which was basically involved bilking people out of money when they walked on the midway and played the games.
You were ushered into this world by a fellow student by the name of Jackie.
Yeah.
And your first encounter with him is basically in the halls of your school and then kind of back in the corner of the cafeteria. Give our listeners a little bit of a sense of that first encounter with this remarkable young man.
Yeah, well, he was really an unusual guy. We were both about 15 or 16 at the time, but he was sort of like had the patter of a Vegas comic. Even though he was that age, he was quite tall, 6 feet, and very sure of himself. And, you know, he took me under his wing, and I really didn't know why at the time, but it turned out that it was because I was good with numbers. And so he brought me onto his business. First, it was working a casino that he had in the basement of his parents' home. And so I helped figure out the odds that would be to our advantage, that sort of thing. And we made a good deal of money from our fellow high school students because they didn't know anything. Not that we were the greatest experts in the world of odds, but our fellow students didn't know a thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, of course, a little bit of this even involved some adults. You weren't just victimizing fellow students.
Right. Later on, then, when I graduated the Carnival Midway, I was about 17 at the time, and I would be playing with people two or three times my age, some of them from relatively sophisticated backgrounds. One guy was a federal a prosecutor. Other person was a major of an Air Force base up in Upper Michigan, and I would win $200 or $300 from people of that order. Again, not thinking of it, I was just a good student of the Carnival Con, just as I had been a good student in high school. I didn't have a particular con. I guess I had a con man's heart, and I didn't know it. At least I did for a few years.
This book, of course, is about more than that life which you were living. It's also about the family situation which you came out of and which your friend Jackie came out of. And
right.
His situation, of course, especially horrific, I think, but
yeah.
Yours not an easy one either.
Right. It is a memoir, and so it has that. It starts out with our family backgrounds. Mine, I had the typical dysfunctional family with an alcoholic father, and which made me a real withdrawn sort of kid, which is why I was waiting for somebody, I guess, like Jackie to come along and help me get out of myself. He came from a very dysfunctional background as well. His parents were both carnies, and they treated him and everybody else sort of like a mark or a sucker. And so it was. He was constantly battling against them to, you know, kind of stand on his own. Now, the interesting thing is we wound up eventually going in opposite directions. I kind of gravitated to the carnival, and he wanted to go into the legitimate life to get away from it. So he, after the carnival years, went to business school, University of Michigan, and now is a professor in the business school at Wayne State University in Detroit.
And I'm pretty sure you have yet to meet as adults.
We haven't met, but after the book came out, he actually called up. There was a review of it in the New York Times. He found out about it, and he gave me a call, and he said, you know, and I was, of course, tense about how he would take it, but he said, hey, it was great, and you got it 95% there in terms of what I believe is the way it happened. So that was kind of gratifying. His actual name is Edward King, and he teaches small business development at Wayne State University. So it was sort of an appropriate background. I don't know how many people know that he started out as a carny and now is telling them how to run their Baskin-Robbins
Wow. Or
that sort of thing.
The other thing that we, of course, really learn through this book is not just your own story, but we learn a lot about the world of the carnival, and in particular, the extraordinary hierarchy, albeit maybe a somewhat informal hierarchy, which exists. Just tell our listeners briefly about that and the experience of climbing through the ranks as you did.
Right. When you walk down the midway, there are all these all the games, and you really don't know that there is this hierarchy of carnival agent, as they're called. You start out as a what they call a hanky pank operator, and that's the games like a duck pond or hitting a balloon with a dart, that sort of thing, and that's generally run by raw beginners like myself when I first started out, or guys who've kind of been broken down by the harsh carny system. The next step up is called the alibi store, and those are games where the carnival huckster is able to has an alibi why the customer didn't win. Those are generally games of skill, like throwing the baseball and knocking the cat off the shelf or the basketball through the hoop, that sort of thing. So even though the game is rigged or gaffed, as the saying goes, the alibi agent says, well, you threw the ball too fast or you threw it too slow, that sort of thing. There's always an excuse. And those are pretty rough because you're physically rough because you're up against people who have balls in their hand or bowling pins, that sort of thing, depending on the game. And they're standing you're standing face to face with them and taking money from them. The next, the highest level, which is one I reached when I was only 17, was generically called a flat store. And it's difficult to describe on the radio, but it's basically, it's kind of like a roulette wheel type game, that sort of thing. And just involves counting numbers. And what the agent or carnival con does is just keep one step ahead of the customer in the counting and so that they can manipulate the course of the game to make it appear that you're going to win very quickly, very early on, and then just keep you just on the precipice of winning, but never going all the way over the rest of the game, and that's where the person starts to lose. So there is that hierarchy, and they even dress differently. The hanky panks, the guys in the bottom, you know, they'll maybe, you know, they'll dress in blue jeans, that sort of thing, and they'll sleep under the trailer at night if they haven't had a good week. And the carny and the flatties, the flat store agents at the top of the ladder, they'll have a hotel room and wear sharkskin pants, wander under the midway, maybe in the middle of the afternoon after having had a steak dinner at the local Sizzler restaurant or something like that. And there's definitely a pecking order.
That's just one of the fascinating things we learn about life in the carnival in your book called Eyeing the Flash, published by Simon & Schuster, the author Peter Fenton. Peter Fenton, I much enjoyed this book and talking with you about it today on the Morning
Wonderful.
Show. Best wishes.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear the interview I recorded with Kelly Scroggins Powell, co-founder and executive director of a group called Racine Women for Racial Justice. And on Friday, you'll hear my conversation with Christopher Clary, tennis correspondent for the New York Times, who has just penned an absolutely remarkable book about one of the greatest players ever to play the game of tennis, Roger Federer. His new book is called The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer. That will be on Friday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and available